First Take, your take on ESPN Radio, the ESPN app, Sirius XM, Channel 80, and ESPN News. I'm Jason Fitz. We start, as always, with the headlines that you need to know. We'll get you a little bit of golf news. That's right, golf news. The PGA Championship is going to be held. It's going to be held without fans. It's been given the green light to be held at Harding Park. So the first major championship to be contested in 2020, the PGA Championship, will be played at San Francisco's Harding Park, but with no spectators. The PGA of America announced the decision on Monday after spending months considering other scenarios, including moving the tournament to other venues. So the organization decided to stick with its original site for the rescheduled tournament, which will be played August 6th through the 9th. The PGA had been originally scheduled for May 14th through 17th, obviously rescheduled due to the coronavirus pandemic. Next up on the headlines that you need to know, racing icon Richard Petty will attend Monday's NASCAR Cup Series race at Talladega Super Speedway to stand in solidarity with Bubba Wallace. Sources have told ESPN's Marty Smith, Petty decided to travel to the Alabama Super Speedway after a noose was found in Wallace's garage stall Sunday. Sources tell Smith that Petty was, quote, the most important thing for me, that Petty said, quote, the most important thing for me right now is hugging my driver. The race had been postponed from Sunday because of inclement weather. It'll mark the first race that Petty, at the age of 82, attends since the sport was shut down because of the coronavirus pandemic. Speaking of the coronavirus pandemic, before you hear from West Virginia, Best Virginia, one of the 24 teams in this year's version of the basketball tournament, TBT for short, has withdrawn from the event after one of its tested positive for COVID-19. The team has been anchored by several former West Virginia standouts, will not be a part of the competition. Per TBT officials, Best Virginia had the opportunity to compete without the player who tested positive, but instead chose to leave the competition. Best Virginia's remaining players would have been required to undergo multiple tests and quarantine for 14 days as part of the health and safety plan. Event officials said they learned about the positive test late last week. So, one less team in the TBT. Those are the headlines that you need. First Take, your take on ESPN Radio, the ESPN app, SiriusXM, Channel 80, ESPN News. Heck, you can even just ask your smart speakers to play ESPN Radio. Get you right to us. I'm Jason Fitz. We're presented by Progressive Insurance, and all of our guests join us on the Shell Penzo Performance Line. Speaking of Progressive Insurance, don't forget Shower Sessions, part interview, part concert, all from the Shower. Grammy winner St. Vincent invites up-and-coming artists to sing, share, and get funky, all in the sound booth of the home, the shower. Watch now at youtube.com/progressive. And yes, Golic Wingo this morning, Mike Golic Sr. was correct when he said everybody sounds good in the shower. It's true. It's a fact. Everybody sings in the shower. Everybody sounds good in the shower. Right now, Dak Prescott is singing in a shower made of gold, if he chooses to, because he signed his franchise tag. Now, let's remember that this doesn't mean anything towards the long-term negotiation date. July 15th is still the cutoff. If they don't have a new deal by July 15th, they can't sign a new long-term deal. So July 15th is when long-term negotiations, at least for now, end for the Cowboys. So now we know that Dak has signed his one-year tender, which puts him at around $31.5 million. So the question is, should he now sign a franchise tag moving forward? Should he sign a mega deal? What should he do? Should he have signed this contract? How should he move it forward? Stephen A. and Marcus Spears broke down what he should do with the franchise tag today on First Take.
He should not sign it. And I get all of the things as to why he would as an individual. And I can't say, if I was Dak in this position, that I wouldn't sign it. If I'm looking at the potential of making $31.4 million, and over my career, I've made right at $4 million. I get it from all of that standpoint. I get it. From a leverage standpoint, when I still contest, when Dallas signed Andy Dalton, that is when they truly created leverage, because they had a guy that you could at least put out on the field and have some level of success with. I thought that was a play based on what this Dak Prescott situation was. Also, when you look at everything that's transpired from the beginning, I just cannot shift my mind from the amount of people that's been paid long-term contracts. Zeke with the Cabo. Zeke held out legitimately with 2 to 3 years left before he could actually come to the negotiating table. Amari Cooper got $100 million contract and guarantees of north of half of that. So when we start looking at everything that's transpired between Dak Prescott beginning to negotiate a contract with the Dallas Cowboys to us hearing that the numbers were too big for Dallas to entertain, to hearing that the amount of years is the impasse that they're at, which is still the same scenario, I still say Dak Prescott should not sign a franchise tag. Because It's one thing I know that's going to happen, regardless. Dak Prescott gonna play quarterback for somebody if he wasn't going to play for the Cowboys. There are a lot of people that would have been in business for Dak Prescott's services in the NFL today, based on what's happening and how well he's played, to speak to the amount of success that he's had coming in as a low-round draft pick and having to take over immediately when he showed up to Dallas. I get it. I get everything. I get the pandemic, that you are unsure about what the NFL is going to be, what it's going to look like. I still say $34.4 million as opposed to the possibility of being able to get upwards to $100 million guaranteed. Fighting to try to get those numbers, this long, arduous process that you've been through in order to try to get the long-term deal you want. So to me, this is Dak Prescott feeling that leverage that Dallas created, feeling the pressure of the possibility of a season being cut short, and also just succumbing to the fact that he's just gave in on that they're not going to get a long-term deal done or they won't agree to his terms. It's not bad to take $31.4 million. That's not what I'm saying. But it is bad when in context you could have got upwards of $100-plus million guaranteed.
Well, I think that the first order of business is to give the American people a sincere apology. I mean, after all, I thought that they would have a break from the two-hour drivel that Max Kellerman usually spews over the national airwaves. And here Marcus Spears is imitating Max. On one hand, you say that, you know what, you understand those that would that you understand if Dak Prescott signs it. And you also say you're not saying you wouldn't do it if you were him. But in the same breath, you're saying that you would ultimately end up doing it. This is what I don't understand here. Here's the reality of the situation. The Dallas Cowboys have his rights, and because they have his rights and he can't just sit up there and get traded, you're in a pinch, particularly in light of the COVID-19 pandemic, how it's going to ravage a lot of NFL franchises, or at least they're going to pretend that it has ravaged them. It's compromised their bottom line. The cap is expected to dissipate because of that. But the number that Dak Prescott is scheduled to make would still be there. As a result, he'd have a catastrophic effect against the cap in the future, in the event that the Dallas Cowboys don't reach a long-term deal with him, which ultimately assigns the leverage to him all day long. I have been on the mind of the mindset, just like you, Marcus Spears, there's no way in hell that if I'm Dak Prescott, I would sign this contract. But that was pre-COVID-19. Once COVID-19 kicked in, you're looking at the state of the National Football League, how these owners are going to use it as an excuse to say they're hemorrhaging money, at least to some degree. Let's remember, ladies and gentlemen, that when the owners were making money hand over foot, they were making, literally, they received a check for $226 million apiece off of their television deal, and they were still worried about the Colin Kaepernick effect on their bottom line. And Colin Kaepernick ain't COVID-19. And so regardless of the situation that we're looking at, here's what the bottom line is. $31.4 million this year. You're counting 30. You're scheduled to make at least 37 next year if they try to franchise tag you again. That number will go up to nearly 50 if they try to franchise tag you after that. But you don't necessarily just have the right for a couple of years to just get up and leave and go somewhere else. Because of that, and the fact that you're hell-bent on playing football and you just played for $2 million last season, you take the $31.4 million now, you try to negotiate that four-year deal, or, you know, before July 15th, and in the event that that doesn't happen, if you roll the dice on $2 million, you can roll the dice on $31 million. What it ensures, however, is that pandemic or no pandemic, you, Dak Prescott, are going to get paid, because what we're really talking about here, Marcus, is we ain't talking about the brother getting $40 million. We talk about him getting $35 million. So what we're really fighting over here is $3.5 million or 3.6.
First, take your take on ESPN Radio, ESPN News, presented by Progressive Insurance. And no, that's not what we're really fighting about. If anybody thinks we're fighting about dollars and cents, I just don't think that's accurate. We're fighting about number of years. I mean, I can't stress this enough. Somehow we have lost part of the conversation that every Cowboys insider has told us, which is that the Cowboys want Dak locked up for 5 years. He only wants to be locked up for 4 years so he can get back to the open market. That's far more substantial than any of the monetary conversations we're having. This isn't about money. It's not about the Cowboys not believing in him. In fact, it's about the Cowboys believing in him so much that they want Dak for longer. That's why this is going to get done. We've turned this into a sensational story using very little of the facts that we're being given, which are that the Cowboys are prepared to pay Dak for 5 years. So Do I have any doubt that it's going to get done? No. Do I believe that even with the leverage, it changes anything in the conversation? No. Do I understand why it's taken this long? No. Does it matter? No. That's the biggest part of it. Because ultimately, for anyone that thinks that suddenly the Cowboys simply can't sign him this year and go 1 year because of the cap consequences for next year, I would challenge that the Cowboys can figure it out because, frankly, teams figure it out. More often than not, teams find a way to figure out what their cap situation looks like no matter what they're dealing with moving forward. So for anyone that thinks that suddenly the Cowboys have been out-negotiated to a spot where they have no standing in the future and what this looks like, I would absolutely challenge whether or not that's true. So obviously the Dak conversation is going to keep going and keep going no matter what until we get a long-term deal. So rather than take your take on that for the 15th time, I want to switch gears again because remember the big story over the course of the weekend was around NASCAR and a couple of things with NASCAR. Obviously Bubba Wallace finding a noose in his work stall. That was one portion of it. Also Confederate flag being flown over the event and, you know, about 20, 25 trucks that chose to come outside the event and fly the flag from their truck. So I want to get some sense on it from what I think is one of the most unique people covering NASCAR, particularly for this conversation. NASCAR contributor for The Guardian, Andrew Lawrence, joins us. Drew, thanks so much for the time, man. I hope you and yours are safe, and I really appreciate it. And I appreciate your insight on this, because for anyone that doesn't know, you're one of the few black people that are covering NASCAR. So before we get into any of the other sort of conversations about specifics over the weekend, walk me through what it's like being one of the few black people that cover a sport that has this sort of reputation, that's had this past, and that has this sort of appearance that it's not always welcoming.
It's definitely eerie. You know, I can remember going to tracks, not Talladega, but certainly other tracks just around the country, and the drive-in is a real, you know, sort of gut-check moment where you just, you know, besieged by this onslaught of Confederate flags, you know, giant Confederate flags waving, you know, in the air, you know, stuck on motor coaches and RVs, taking on all kinds of forms in clothing and accessories. And, you know, the embrace of this this supposed symbol of Southern heritage is very real and very sort of nauseating for, you know, somebody like me who had to work in that space. And also just for, you know, people like me who enjoy racing and follow the sport and follow NASCAR and are very much like disinclined to attend an event because that imagery is so strong. And the fact that that it's taken this much for you know, a global pandemic and a reckoning on anti-black racism happening at the exact same time, for NASCAR to be like, you know what, we should really do something about that flag, is really kind of shameful.
We're talking to Andrew Lawrence, NASCAR contributor for The Guardian, and I think that's really interesting, Drew, because you know, you hear oftentimes you see the flag, and in case you're not familiar with anything, for me, I toured in country music for a long time, and I saw those flags. Okay. At a lot of events. And one thing that's always sort of been surprising to me is how many people fly the flag and just don't have an understanding to how hurtful it is. So what is the tone and approach been when you've actually interacted with fans to you specifically?
Well, fans, I feel like they are just, you know, you can't sort of get them off of the Southern pride argument that, you know, any attempt to present them with the actual facts of that flag, of the actual evolution of that flag, of not even sort of taking on that form when it was used as a war flag in the Civil War, to its eventual the current permutation that was very much you know, sort of something that evolved with Jim Crow and segregation, and very much as sort of a an intimidation symbol for blacks in this country. Like, there's just no having that argument. It's just, this is a thing that I like, and as much as I like, you know, Miller Lite and you know, Dale Jarrett, like, this, you just can't, you know, I don't see them as being like any more threatening than me liking the Bulls or something like that. These are just like my things, and if you have a problem with it, like, that's your hang up and you just need to get over it. There's not a real opportunity. I should say there are not a lot of opportunities for introspection when you sort of confront fans about it in that context.
Well, and I think that's an important, and you've really articulated it incredibly well. We're talking to Andrew Lawrence, NASCAR contributor for The Guardian, First Take, Your Take, ESPN Radio. I'm Jason Fitz. I can't tell you how many people I've interacted with that believe, just like you said, it's like my Miller Lite, my Confederate flag, in my case for many years, my country music. I'm not a racist. I just fly this flag. I think a lot of people don't understand the pain that it comes with. Interesting portion of this. Now, walk me through what it's like being, because as somebody covering the sport, you're also dealing with the drivers and the people around NASCAR. Now we see a noose found in Bubba Wallace's work area, you know, and we're hearing from drivers. There seems to be solidarity. So what's the culture like when it comes to race specifically within the NASCAR drivers and the people that run the organization?
Well, I feel like that's what's interesting, the sort of cognitive dissonance between NASCAR, the sport, and NASCAR, the culture. Like, I feel like the sport is extremely sort of progressive-minded and really wants to open the tent up to more fans. And sort of where I came into the sport was very, very much chronicling the rise of drivers like Bubba, like Kyle Larson, you know, the drivers who would really be sort of the faces who would attract, who would help broaden NASCAR's fan base. And I feel like the rank and file guys, at least in the Cup Series and the Stars, are very much, you know, would like their sport to be as big and as inclusive as, you know, the NFL or college football. But there's sort of very much this blockage where it's just like, you know, it's sort of like you're cutting your nose to spite your face. Like, you can't, fully committing to being on the road to progress means, disenfranchising the people who sort of make up our fan base, who we sort of packaged and sold this sport to as an extension of that Southern pride thing that their flag represents. So I feel like NASCAR really does Bubba a disservice by sort of having this this moment of awakening now, when really it should have happened 20 years ago, 40 years ago, immediately after or even immediately after Wendell Scott's retirement. It's just strange that, you know, to think that Wendell Scott, the first black driver to compete in the top level of NASCAR, and Jackie Robinson were contemporaries, and we can point to the change that has happened in baseball over the last few years and draw a direct line from Jackie to Mookie Betts. But in NASCAR, it's Wendell, it's two other guys, and then it's Bubba, and it's just that's like how do you live with yourself as a sport, knowing that that's as far as you've come in that same amount of time.
It's interesting stuff. We're talking to Drew Lawrence. You can follow him on Twitter, by the way, @by_Drew. So obviously we haven't heard anything yet from NASCAR, who says they're going to figure this out. They're going to get to the bottom of who hung a noose in Bubba Wallace's work area, but we haven't heard anything yet. What's your reaction to that?
I saw a tweet from Steve Phelps, the NASCAR president, saying that, they don't have any suspects lined up, but they plan to ban whoever did it for life. And to me, that sort of feels a little bit weak sauce. Just sort of knowing the tight crowd control that NASCAR had over this event. You know, we're talking about, you know, they only let 5,000 non sort of hard card carrying people into this event in the first place as to be spectators. And then also just with, this is not only a network televised event, but the track itself is littered with cameras. It has five giant video boards that supposedly, are embedded with the facial recognition technology. Like, this, you know, this is one sporting event that's particularly well suited to being able to find the needle in the haystack. And the fact that, like, they're still, you know, the jury's still out, it's an unsatisfactory outcome at this point.
You guys can follow him on Twitter at @by_Drew. Obviously, you can read him all over the place. Drew Lawrence, Drew, I really appreciate your insight on this, your expertise on this. Hope we can have you back on and we can talk about actual racing. But in the meantime, having these conversations continue forward is important. I really appreciate you being a part of it here.
Thank you, Jason. It's a pleasure.
So you can follow him on Twitter at @by_Drew. Drew Lawrence, NASCAR contributor for The Guardian. Smart stuff from him there, and really poignant stuff when it comes to some of the conversation around the Confederate flag that we need to continue. I mean, that it's going to continue, and the conversation should continue. We're presented by Pennzoil Synthetic Motor Oils, made from natural gas. Gives you unbeatable engine protection. The proof is in the Pennzoil, based on Sequence 4A wear test using SAE 5W30. Next on First Take, Your Take. I want to get your thoughts. 888-SAY-ESPN, 888-729-3776. We've heard from Major League Baseball players. We've heard from NFL players. We've heard from NBA players. We haven't really heard from college football players on whether they should have to play this year. Should college football players have an equal say on whether or not they're going to play? 888-SAY-ESPN, 888-729-3776. I want your take. Plus, you'll hear what First Take thought about it, and you'll get my thoughts. That's all coming up next. But first, it's time for some straight talk. Even though most live sports are on hold right now, big wireless companies are still playing games. Just ask me what Verizon is trying to do to me. It is disgusting. It's ugly. It's gross. They're all trying to lock you into overpriced contracts, and none of them are taking care of you. With Straight Talk Wireless, there are no contracts. Runs on America's best networks, same as the big carriers, but you save up to 50%. $45 a month gets you the unlimited plan with 25 gigs of high-speed data, then 2G. You might miss sports, but don't play games. You'll lose, especially not Verizon. Not worth it. Straight Talk Wireless, no contracts, no compromise. Savings may vary. See terms and conditions at straighttalk.com. I want your straight talk on what college football players should have as far as a say and if they should play. We'll get more of your take coming next. First Take, Your Take, ESPN Radio, ESPN News. First Take, Your Take on ESPN Radio, the ESPN app, Sirius XM, Channel 80, and ESPN News. I'm Jason Fitz. I want you guys to chime in on what we're about to get into, okay, because a lot of conversation around college sports that's different than everything else. And it's part of why I've struggled, frankly, with the COVID-19 discussion. Don't forget, by the way, to tune into the ESPN Daily Podcast. Get you a deep dive into a single story from one of ESPN's hundreds of reporters presented by Marathon. Download, subscribe, and review ESPN Daily, available wherever you enjoy your podcast. Now, I struggle because nobody's here to fight for college kids. You can tell me coaches fight for them. You can tell me programs fight for them. And the fact is, I just don't believe that. I mean, ultimately, a coach has got to make a determination on playing time. A coach has got to have a standard of what they expect college kids to give up. And college kids have a God complex. Most of them believe that they can make it through COVID-19 completely untouchable. I mean, frankly, who didn't have that complex when they were in college? We all did. So trying to figure out who's fighting for college kids is difficult for me, because as I look across the board and I figure out whether or not college football players have a voice, it leads to a question. In an empowered world where we've seen college players come out and speak on social issues, and we've seen college players come out and talk about what's important to them in life, at what point are they allowed to collectively come out without being a union, but collectively come out and have some version of equal say on whether or not they play this season? Marcus and Stephen A. had a huge debate. Marcus Spears, Stephen A. Smith had a huge debate today on First Take about whether or not college football players should have equal say on if this season is played.
This is a part of the conversation that's been going on for a long time about college football players. Obviously, you don't give them full authority. There are decisions that need to be made by adults who have been hired to make certain decisions when it comes to football. But when you talk about players making the decision to go back and play during a pandemic, what we see happening on college campuses across the country, you damn right they should be involved in the decision-making process and be as much of the decision-making process as anybody else, because they are the actual ones that's out there doing the job. So when I think about all of the things that are transpiring, and we see these cases taking rises and things are happening while teams, while players are getting back on campus, I'm not naive to think that the NCAA, that college programs, institutions, the NFL, NBA, I'm not naive to think that they would see cases. I'm not naive to think that players wouldn't get it. But I tell you this, if we lose one player in football, one player to COVID, it was not worth it. And that is what everybody is trying to avoid. That is why we talk about protocols and shutting things down when they see cases rise. What is the plan? What is the contingency plan? If we come back and we start playing a season and we see catastrophic things happen, what are we going to do about parents that are concerned about these athletes going back on campus and playing in the midst of a pandemic? Ohio State giving waivers for players and parents to sign. All of these precautionary things are to avoid a possibility of the worst possible outcome. And if there is a possibility of the worst possible outcome, the people that are in the position to suffer from that worst possible outcome should be a part of the decision-making process, whether to go forward, if they're going to be a part of what is going to transpire during football season. If one of these players suffer from COVID-19 and lose their life, it wasn't worth it. And the conversation won't be, well, it's just one guy. No, it won't be the case. We've dealt with CTE in football. We've dealt with heat strokes. We've dealt with all of these things that affect from the game. This is totally different because we still don't know everything about what this disease is. So with that being said, yes, they should be a part of the decision-making process and they should be a major part of it.
Should college football players have quote unquote equal say on playing this season? Hell no. You know why? FBS alone, there's 128 Division I programs, 85 players on scholarship or financial aid. That is 10,808 different dudes, okay? All with their own individual interests, or at least a clique interest per se. It is impossible to expect them to all come together because they're all not going to have the same interest, because the interest transcends just actually playing football. It's the program you're playing for. It's the money that's been put into that program. It's the level of safety protocols that they've instituted. What's available to you and what's not available to you. And we haven't even taken into account the student body. Should you consult with players and let them know what the conditions are and let them know what hear their concerns? Of course you should. Should you take that into consideration before making your decision? Sure. Should we have been pushing all along for the players, the student athletes themselves, to have actual representation, a la a student athlete association, to represent their interests? Sure. But at some point in time, a decision has to be made, and you can't leave that up to kids. Yes, their parents, even their parents, Stephen, come into the equation. It's of course not, you listen to them.
No.
But one parent,
no.
But one parent's interest might be different than the other.
To recap, we shouldn't be listening to the people that are actually putting themselves at risk. I mean, Stephen A. just gave you a lot of stats that are important about how many college football programs there are and how many scholarship kids there are in each of those programs. Those are important stats, but let's not get it twisted. A college has a main objective for every single student that walks onto that campus, whether you're an athlete or not, and that is to educate you, to help you advance your life in the safest possible environment. That is part of what every single college is charged with across the country. They have an obligation, not an opportunity, an obligation to do everything they possibly can as a college to protect the kids that walk onto that campus. Tell me why a student athlete doesn't deserve that same protection. Tell me why a student athlete, because they play a sport that we need them to play, why that student athlete doesn't have every opportunity to be protected by the school. Look, let's not get it twisted. I need college football to come back personally. I've made this very clear. One of the biggest things that I've hitched my career wagon to is college football. The opportunity to travel with Game Day last year was huge for me and my profile. I make no bones about it. The work I've done in college football is a large part of what's helped me grow at ESPN. I'm desperate for the sport to return. But Marcus isn't wrong when he talks about the fact that there's kids being put at risk and they should have some say in that level of risk. I mean, I understand the concept that they're kids, but they're also old enough to die for our country. If you're old enough to die for the country, you don't have the right to decide what level of comfort you should be forced to put yourself into? Come on now. Like, we need to stop seeing athletes at the college level, and unless we're going to let them unionize and profit and make a bunch of money, we need to stop looking at them like they are suddenly pawns in a game. They are people. They are kids that should get the opportunity to be protected the same as the math kids, the same as the science kids, the same as the music kids, right? And that means that they should have some level of say. And what do you do when the level of say you know could affect the way you make a living for the rest of your life? How can you be free to have a level of say when you know that what you say may cost you your position, may cost you snaps, may cost you the opportunity just by voicing concerns? It could create a culture where suddenly your coach doesn't think you're, air quotes, tough enough. Now, risk is taken constantly. Marcus Spears alluded to it. We certainly haven't shut down college football for the fear of CTE. We certainly haven't shut down college football for the fear of paralyzation or through the fear of, frankly, death. As Marcus says, it would only take one kid getting COVID-19 and it wasn't worth it. Well, it only takes one kid having a catastrophic life-changing injury and you could argue the sport wasn't worth it. So I understand that the sport in and of itself comes with risk. All right? I get that. But through the process and conversation of risk, kids should be allowed at least to have an understanding of the risk they're being asked to take, why they're being asked to take it, what the repercussions will be. I mean, at this point, we've seen enough on CTE that at least when you are a college athlete, you can make informed decisions about what you're comfortable with for your personal life. When it comes to the risk of injury in general in football, we've seen enough. We've read enough. There have been enough studies and specials. There's been enough conversation about it that these kids know the risk they're putting themselves into. With COVID-19, they honestly don't. So if you're not going to protect any of the kids on your campus, fine. That's your campus's decision. But to decide willy-nilly that you're not going to offer the same level of protection to a kid that you would any other athlete or any other student on your campus simply because they play a sport is asinine. And then to imply that through all of it, that the kid should be aware but not have a voice? Why? Why would you possibly try and silence the kids that are putting themselves on the field and at risk? I would ask Stephen A. or anybody else that thinks that silencing is appropriate when we get to make that line, where we get to make that line. Is it okay to silence kids on social justice issues? Is it okay to silence kids on what they think is important to them? Or is it just okay to silence them when it comes to having a voice in their own injury issues? Is it only okay to silence them when it comes to their health and safety? I'm not asking for college football not to happen. I'm just asking for people not to be hypocritical in the process of the conversation about it. If you believe college football should happen just because we need it, if you are like me and you believe that it's going to happen because the money is too big if it doesn't, at least be transparent about it. Don't try and hide it under anybody doing anybody any good and acknowledge that the reason we're talking about it in that way is quite simply because we want it and because we see the dollars and cents attached to it and the kids' health be damned. Because that's the real statement that's going to be made by colleges and across the landscape if they hold the kids to any different level of accountability simply because they wear a jersey on Saturdays and that's different than what they ask for other kids. It's First Take, your take on ESPN Radio, ESPN News. Fired up about it. I'm also fired up about Brett Favre's words. I know you will be too. Some of you guys want to chime in, get your take in. We'll let you do that next. Plus, Brett Favre says Colin Kaepernick deserves a hero status the same as former NFL star Pat Tillman. You'll hear what First Take had to say about that, plus my take coming next. First Take, your take, ESPN Radio, ESPN News.
It's your home speaking, and I need you to do me a couple of favors. First, could you get that blueberry that rolled under the fridge last week? It's throwing my feng shui off. Second thing, bundle your home and car insurance with GEICO. It's easy, and we could save money. Lastly, I know you were thinking of painting the nursery back to off-white, but I'm actually feeling this baby blue. Didn't think it was my color, but I am pulling it off.
GEICO. For bundling made easy, go to geico.com today.
First Take, your take on ESPN Radio, the ESPN app, Sirius XM, Channel 80, ESPN News. I'm Jason Fitz. Just blowing up the rest of the show. We continue. This is the peek behind the curtain. Sometimes as I get on a roll and I say some things, it gets the staff thinking. And one of the best things about hosting shows at ESPN is that we have great people behind the scenes that you don't hear from every day. But their job is not only to produce a great show, but also to help push our thought process. And that's one of the things I love about being on ESPN Radio is that when we sit down to prep a show, we actually have long drawn out debates about what each of us think. And it makes people think differently. And then sometimes we push each other. So today, in addition to Shannon and Connor, we also have Mike A. working on the show. And Mike A., you disagreed with some of my thoughts from the last segment as we were talking about whether college football athletes should have an equal say in whether or not they come back. So I'll give you the chance. Let's bring the behind the scenes to the front of the scenes, Mike. Where are you on this?
I would just say that the players do have a say, but that doesn't mean that the organization, the universities, the teams have to listen to that say. In other words, I can choose as a player not to play, but that doesn't mean that I have a say in what the team does or the league or the sport.
But shouldn't the players be able to stand up together and say what they, if there's a majority of them that feels a certain way, shouldn't they be able to express that majority collectively? I'm not talking about unionization, but I'm just talking about collective speak on the majority so that things like scholarships can be protected if they choose not to play.
Sure. I mean, you can try, but the problem is, where's the negotiation for the organization, for the school? Where's the negotiation? My choice is either you play, you don't play because you said you won't and I give you a scholarship, or you don't play because you said you won't and I don't. Like, what's in it for me?
Well, you know, I think and that's an interesting point, because I would argue that college football athletes, more than ever, it's like the movie Ants. Everything comes back to children's movies for me, apparently. But remember in the movie Ants when they realize that, hey, we don't have to fall in line. We actually collectively can force whatever change we want to. I believe that college athletes are in that situation, Mike. Like, I believe that if college athletes came together and ran one voice, they would understand, much like they have in Texas, they would understand, hey, our voice has power, and if schools aren't willing to listen and we simply choose not to play, what the hell can the school do about it? Like, they could really put the school behind the eight ball if they just chose on a Friday to say, you know what, we're not safe, we don't feel good here anymore, we're not willing to play.
And as Stephen A. pointed out, with 10,800 and some odd whatever, you think you're going to get a majority, or do you think there's a lot of kids that either A, love the idea of being the college football player so much, or B, need it for the education, need it for the ability to be able to pay for their school education, or C, flat out don't agree with this? I think, you know, whether one thinks, I can handle COVID. I'm young and invincible.
And Mike, that's why I love debating with you, because you make some great points, and those are all really valid points. I don't think that the entire college football landscape can have one consensus. And this is something I've said a lot that I think we need to be prepared for. I mean, UCLA players have come out, according to reports, and they've asked that outside officials be involved in the COVID-19 process, because they simply don't trust the testing process enough for UCLA. That speaks to behind the scenes, the culture that we don't always see, right? And it's a reminder that every institution is going to handle this differently. Am I suggesting a mass walkout for all college football players? No. But I am suggesting that some sort of consideration be given, just like it has for the NBA, for players that may not feel comfortable in a COVID-19 era being able to step up, stand out, and speak for themselves. One thing that Adam Silver said when he talked to Mike Greenberg on the commissioner's special is that, frankly, they would respect the players' decisions, because they understand that the players are playing for a lot, not just for the money, not just for the moment, but also for their futures. I would be curious to see how different colleges handle these things, because there is going to be an extra magnifying glass on what it looks like. We live in a world now where college coaches are going to be judged by what they say in important moments, and colleges are going to be judged at some level for how they're handling these huge moments, because it matters to the future of recruiting. If I'm a young person right now and I'm looking across the landscape, picking where I want to go, especially if I'm a young black athlete, it may matter to me at some point how coaches are speaking or not speaking on certain issues. But if I'm a family that's looking at COVID-19 specifically, I might be keeping all eyes on how the medical staff is handling this. What does it mean moving forward? Because kids understand they have a voice, and also they have a choice. We've seen an empowerment in college football athletes that I think is just the beginning over the course of the last few months of what we'll see over the course of the next few years. As that empowerment grows, they're going to find out that they have more collective voice than ever, even without unionization or even without some sort of skin in the game in that sense. College football players are going to understand that they can have power in their own futures and the way business is done. That's something I look forward to as college football players continue to grow in front of our very eyes. Coming up next, the Will Cain Show. Thanks so much for the debate, the discussion. Thanks so much for hanging out with us. First Take Your Take.